Now, in a sleepy part of northern Sydney, just by the beach at Avalon, there is an independent bookstore called Bookachino, whose new owner possesses stories more hair-raising and unlikely than pretty much anything on the shelves. His name is Ray Bonner. He's been a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a war correspondent, a Vietnam veteran. He served with the US Marines in Vietnam. He was a leading lawyer for Ralph Nader's Consumer Rights Crusade. He's exposed massacres, he has angered the US president, he's been spied on by the FBI, and he's busted, or at least helped bust, an innocent man out of jail after he served 27 years on death row. Ray Bonner, what a pleasure it is.
Whose life was that?
How are you going to settle into running a bookstore?
Well, you know, I wasn't about to sit on the beach, so I did the next best thing and bought a bookstore on the beach.
You have an American accent. Why an Australian bookstore on an Australian beach?
Oh, that's a long story. I mean, why not? I mean, one could say. One looks at the temperatures today, and it's 39 here and minus 14 in New York. My wife's Australian. Spent a lot of time here. Love the place. Absolutely love it. I mean, I think it's a terrific country, and it's an iconic bookstore. Opportunity like that doesn't come along very often, and so I heard it was for sale. I knew the owner, and I said, I'll buy it.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
You started off doing law. You studied law. You were working for a law firm, and then you quit that to go and serve in the Vietnam War. What were you thinking of?
Oh, boy, Hugh, that really goes back a long way. I mean, at the time, I suppose my politics were, my country may she always be right, but my country right or wrong. I grew up very conventional. I grew up quite conventionally and then went off the rails. You know, high school, college, law school, military. That was what you did back in those times. What's interesting to me is I recently watched the Ken Burns series Vietnam, which is just extraordinary. And it brought back a lot of memories. I realized I saw that war from both sides. I mean, I went in the Marine Corps to Vietnam. And then I came out and, I mean, I didn't throw my medals over the wall and I didn't take to the streets in protest, but I was against, I realized the war was the wrong war. But at the time, I believed that it was the right thing to do and I didn't want to become a draft dodger.
One of the things that is comes through all the things that you've done is that very notion, my country right or wrong. And in fact, you've looked at a lot of things that the United States has done, and you've decided that it was wrong. I think about things, for example, in El Salvador. Can you tell us about what was going on there?
Well, El Salvador, it's interesting, Hugh, you remember it, but many of your audience, it will be like ancient history to the younger members of your audience. But in 1982, as hard as this is to believe, in 1980, El Salvador was on the front burner of American foreign policy. It was like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan today. El Salvador was getting more money and had a larger embassy than two or three other American embassies around the world. More diplomats in El Salvador than in Delhi. More money than any country other than Israel and Egypt. During the Cold War, the American government, the Reagan administration, were convinced that the communists were going to march on Texas up through El Salvador, as the ambassador used to say, El Salvador, Guatemala, all the way up to the soft underbelly of Kansas. I mean, he was against the policy. That had a bigger impact on me than Vietnam did. I mean, I saw American policy at the time, which was to support, as the ambassador called it, a genocidal, nun-killing junta. You know, this was a government that killed four American nuns. You had soldiers killing four American, raping and killing four American church women, soldiers that were supported by the United States government. So that what I saw in El Salvador was quite dramatic for me, and I think changed my views about the United States, at least in that context.
And you saw U.S.-trained troops. So these were the right-on, right-wing government troops killing villages.
Yeah. One of the massacres was called now the Massacre at El Masote. It lives in infamy. It's the worst massacre in Latin American history. 700 to 1,000 children, old men and women were just gunned down, villagers, by troops that have been trained by the United States government. That makes you begin to think differently about your country.
You're trained as a lawyer. You're trained as a soldier. How did you find the adjustment towards being a witness?
I don't know that I've ever made the link from soldier to lawyer to witness. What is quite clear when you read through all that, I mean, I have what today would be called ADHD. My mother just said, you've got ants in the pants, you can't sit still. And journalism, as you know, really fits that. Every day is different. And you are a witness. You can travel around the world. You see the world. I mean, I witnessed some horrible things. Obviously, I wish I hadn't seen the massacre in El Salvador. With, you know, I can still see the bodies. We're talking 30 plus years later. Clearly see the bodies that I found in the village that day and they were being eaten over by buzzards. So I saw a lot of things that weren't that pleasant, but I saw the world. As a journalist, I saw the world, and the New York Times paid for it.
Not a bad thing to have happen to you, at least getting the money paid for it as you travel around. There's no doubt about that, getting an insight into how human beings behave. You didn't make many friends, or at least in powerful places. Ronald Reagan took notice of your reporting and wasn't impressed.
Nor the Wall Street Journal. They ran an entire editorial condemning me that the massacre never happened. Of course, the documents came out years later and it was clear it did happen. But Hugh, if you want to make friends, don't go into journalism. That's not our job. I mean, it's not our job to poke at people unnecessarily and arbitrarily and capriciously. But if you want to make friends, don't become a journalist.
You looked at stuff overseas and, as you say, Rwanda and in Indonesia and in a whole bunch of places, virtually everywhere in the world, 100 countries or something, but also looking at home, at the United States. You did some astonishing work on the American justice system or injustice system. Yeah. What do you make of the United States in terms of, you know, the land of the brave and the home of the free, its legal system, the sense that the rich have the good lawyers and the poor get long times in jail?
You know, somebody once said to me, it's better to be guilty and rich than innocent and poor. But I have to say, I think the American legal system is pretty good. It's flawed. I've been on both sides. I've been a prosecutor. I've been a defense counsel before I became a journalist. I've looked at it as it's flawed, but it's pretty damn good. It really is. I mean, it's got some weaknesses in it, but it's a pretty good system.
When you look around the world now, what troubles you?
Oh.
What troubles you most, perhaps? We only have limited time.
I guess now that I'm not at the New York Times and not a reporter, I don't have to be totally objective. Donald Trump troubles me greatly.
What about him?
It's dangerous. I mean, when you have your intelligence chiefs saying our biggest threat is North Korea, not Iran, and the president of the United States says they're naive, that's scary. I worry about him tweeting us into a war with North Korea. It's very frightening. It's very scary.
Very friendly with Kim now, of course.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good friend, you know?
Yeah.
That scares me. Climate change is not something we're dealing with. We had young friends out visiting us from Los Angeles in their 30s, both very smart, very intelligent, both have startups. One was a journalist who now started a company. They're not buying a house in Los Angeles. These are kids in their 30s because they're worried about what's going to happen to Los Angeles because of climate change. Now, that's troubling.
Because of lack of water or something?
Well, who knows? You've got forest fires in California. You've got possibility of floods. You've got possibility of no water in Southern California. You've got every possibility imaginable. But to hear these two very smart kids talk about their fears of climate change, and this country, of course, this country should be the leader in the solutions to climate change.
I'm reminded of another New York Times writer, I think James Reston, who said, as a piece of advice to a young person, stick with the optimists. Life's tough enough, even if they're right.
Very good.
And I guess you can't go to a lot of difficult places in the world without being fundamentally optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not pessimistic. I'm not dour. I mean, I wouldn't have bought a bookstore, which is, you know, a tremendous amount of fun. I don't walk around with my, you know, head down and frowning, and I'm optimistic. I mean, even about America, even about Australia, even about any place else, even about Britain under Brexit. But that doesn't mean that there aren't troubling things, you know. And as a journalist, you have the rare opportunity to see these things and to report about them.
Watch history rolling over. Now, you mentioned 1980 as the year that made you. Why 1980?
People ask me, you know, why did you buy a bookstore? You bought a bookstore in the age of Amazon? Are you insane? Are you crazy? Of course, now all my journalistic friends say, I wish I'd have done it. But, I couldn't answer it. It makes no sense. And I realized the only answer I can give is, in 1980, when I was approaching 40 years old, I quit my law job. I locked up my house in San Francisco and I went to Bolivia. And it turned out to be a career in journalism. I ended up a couple of months later, after getting chased out of Bolivia and El Salvador. I got there on Sunday. The American churchwomen were raped and killed on Tuesday. And the rest is history. I became a journalist. That's how I explain what I did now at the age of 76, buying a bookstore. You know, I don't do the conventional.
Your song is Bob Dylan, Blowing in the Wind. What about this song?
Well, it's Bob Dylan. You know, I'm a product of the 60s. I'm in the age of Aquarius in a way. You know, Woodstock, even though I wasn't there. You know, that defined us. That defined a lot of us. And a lot of us look back on that and say, we thought we were going to change the world. We thought we were going to make it better. I'm not sure we did a very good job. And I say to the kids I teach, we've turned it over to you now.
Well, a bookshop will always make the world a better place. So the best of luck with a bookshop. And just a reminder of how people dream the future might be. Here's a bit of Bob Dylan. Thanks so much, Ray Bonner.
Thank you, Hugh.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Must a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times must a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Yes, it still works, doesn't it? Bob Dylan with Blowing in the Wind. About 55 years old, that song.